Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books Network. I'm your host, Schneur Zalman-Neufeld. New York City is a preeminent global city, serving as the headquarters for hundreds of multinational firms and a world-renowned cultural hub for fashion, art, and music. It is among the most multicultural cities in the world, and also one of the most segregated cities in the United States. The people that make this global city function, immigrants, people of color, and the working class, reside largely in the so-called outer boroughs, outside the corporations, neon, and skyscrapers of Manhattan. In A People's Guide to New York City, published by University of California Press in 2022, Carolina Bank Munoz, Penny Lewis, and Emily Thompson Molina expand the scope and scale of traditional guidebooks, providing an equitable exploration of the diverse communities throughout the city. Carolina Bank Munoz is professor of sociology at Brooklyn College and at the City University of New York Graduate Center. Penny Lewis is professor of labor studies at the City University of New York School of Labor and Urban Studies. I'm so glad their new book has brought them to our program. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Oh, great. So to get started, could you each please tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to write this work together? Why don't we start with Carolina?
Sure. Thanks so much. So I got interested in this project 10 years ago when I was on a trip to LA to visit my family in LA. And I went to Roman's bookstore in Pasadena to listen to Laura Pulido and Wendy Chang and Laura Barencroft talk about A People's Guide to Los Angeles. And I was really inspired by this idea of a guidebook. They're all geographers, right? So I was really inspired by this idea of a guidebook as an intellectual project, as an alternative, as a way of creating an alternative vision of cities, of claiming rights to the city. And so I asked, after that talk, I asked Wendy Chang, I said, so are there plans to do other guidebooks in other cities? And Wendy said, yes, we're hoping to make this a series. Do you want to do New York? And I said, how could it be to do New York City? And 10 years later, here we are. Turns out it was pretty hard. So when I came back from that trip, not being a native New Yorker, I thought, who could I get involved in this project? And I reached out to Penny, and then I'll let Penny talk about her.
Terrific.
Yes, it is terrific, and I feel like the email from Carolina felt overdetermined in that I am a native New Yorker, third generation. You know, I grew up with a dad who every time we took a walk anywhere, you know, regaled me with the stories of, you know, what used to be there and, you know, what should be there and why it's a problem that what's there now is there. And I also teach a class called New York City Work Culture and Politics. So I came at this project with a lot of personal and political interest. I've also been really active my whole life in New York in various social justice and labor movements. And, you know, part of what made the LA Guide, you know, so exciting was that it was really foregrounding the ways in which social movements make a city, you know, that everything that we see around us in the city and that we experience in the city is really a product of social struggle. And we don't always know it, and it's not always there on the surface, and it's certainly not something that we read into the physical landscape in any kind of, you know, immediate or natural way. But the LA Guide, and I think our guide, encourages, you know, people to see the city that way. And I certainly grew up understanding the city that way and experienced it that way. So it's been exciting to contribute, you know, and create this book with Carolina and Emily.
Emily is Emily Thompson. Right. And
That's right.
And so speaking of the kind of vision for this book, Carolina, you mentioned in the beginning of your book that many other guidebooks to New York draw attention to the Astor family and its legacy. But you write that if you know where to look and how to listen, different stories can be found as well. What do you mean by that?
So I think that what is known about New York City and what is highlighted about New York City is glitz and glamour and consumption, right? And even in the traditional guidebooks, that's the case. And even in the alternative guidebooks, those guidebooks tend to focus on or overly focus on Manhattan, right, as kind of the center of the city. So I think what we mean by that is listening, right, and hearing the stories of, you know, quote unquote, real people. Not that the Astors aren't real, but working class New Yorkers, the folks that make the city move, the folks that make the city come alive, and that those stories are everywhere. You know, I mean, Penny just kind of alluded to that in terms of her dad, right, telling these stories about what was here and what was there. And you can, that happens all the time. I mean, almost every time I ride the subway and I get into a conversation with somebody and they say, oh, what do you do? Oh, I teach at Brooklyn College. Brooklyn College, my grandmother went to Brooklyn College, right? My uncle went to Brooklyn College. My great-grandmother went to Brooklyn, you know. So the stories of people who make the city, that's what you get by listening.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know if I should come in also.
Please feel free to jump in.
That opening story, you know, we begin the book looking at the Empire State Building, right? And, you know, that is a kind of, it's one of the types of sites that we have in the book, you know, which is an iconic site. Everybody thinks they know about the Empire State Building. You know, it's, everyone can see it. It's such a symbol of the whole city. And, you know, we try to pull out and ask questions about the people who built it, right? And when it was built and why it was, you know, built when it was built. And we end up taking a journey from Midtown Manhattan to Brooklyn, where there's now a hairdresser's, or a beauty salon. I don't know what we would call it, on Nevin Street, where there used to be a bar called the Wigwam. And it was called the Wigwam because it was a bar that served a Mohawk, a Native Canadian Mohawk community, the Kahnawake, who iron workers who lived in the neighborhood and who were some of the most essential workers in building not just the Empire State Building, but Rockefeller Center and a lot of other buildings in New York. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that if you are asking different kinds of questions about the monuments of New York, you end up going in completely different directions and landing in the completely different spaces in New York. And I think, you know, just rethinking these connections, as Carolina was saying, between like, what's at the center, what's at the periphery, you know, what makes New York City so famous and amazing? You know, is it the Astors whose property was built in order to put the Empire State Building there? Or, you know, is it the Mohawk ironworkers?
Right. And so kind of along those lines, I'm curious, does your book focus on the same sites as other guidebooks, but just tells different stories about those locations? Or does it also include sites that are usually ignored?
I think it does. It does three things. It talks about, we spend a lot of time talking about the layers, right? And peeling through the layers of these sites. So some of the sites are common sites with alternative stories, right? So like the Empire State Building or the Statue of Liberty. Some sites are vanished sites, right? Sites that no longer exist in that location, like the Silver Palace restaurant, which was the first Chinese restaurant to be unionized in China, in Manhattan Chinatown, which is now a hotel, right? And some sites are just ignored. So I think those are the three kinds of sites that we cover in the book.
Right. I'm curious if you could, just to follow up, Caroline, if you could give a few examples of sites that that are significant to the New York history that are no longer exist, that are covered in your book.
So, besides the Silver Palace is the one that very quickly came to mind. Penny, do you have other of the disappeared sites?
Well, I mean, and not necessarily of, you know, significance to New York in that people don't know that it existed. But, you know, we have like the Margaret Sanger's first, you know, the very first place that contraception advice was shared in New York, her first clinic in Brownsville, Brooklyn. You know, it was the very first time that someone publicly opened the doors to talk to people about, you know, contraceptive health. And of course it was shut down and she was arrested and, you know, it didn't last long. But that's, you know, one kind of vanished site that we have. You know, we often, there are also sites like the, I often pick this site because it's so close to where I grew up, but the Village East Cinema is one of the very few, it's one of the only remaining theaters that used to be part of what was known as the Yiddish Rialto on the Lower East Side, you know, where there were a lot of Jewish theaters and it was at the center of the Yiddish theater scene. And it's still there. But all around it, you know, are the vanished sites of what had been a really thriving community.
Right, right. And sorry.
And
go
just
ahead.
One more example is the storefront museum, right? Which was this accessible like center for Afrocentric philosophy, and was eventually closed. You know, so now that building no longer exists. It's part of like York College. The collection is now part of York College.
Mm. Yeah, there are dozens of spaces like this in the book, or at least, yeah, dozens. I'm looking over.
Right, right. And I'm curious, Penny, if you could think of, again, I don't want to put anyone on the spot, but I'm curious if you could think of examples from the book of places that still exist, but are, you know, really largely ignored by kind of traditional New York guidebooks.
Sure. I mean, we, for example, one of the themes in our book that we don't, that you wouldn't normally see in a guidebook is questions of social reproduction, right? Like, how do New Yorkers live, right? And we need education, we need healthcare, and we need food to live. So, you know, one site that you would never find in a guidebook that we include is Hunts Point. which is the food distribution center for, it's one of a few, but it is the one that brings in like a quarter of all the fresh fruit and vegetables. You know, it sits on hundreds of acres in the Bronx, on the Hunts Point Peninsula. And it's, you know, it's notable. It's got like the fish market there is second only to Tokyo's fish market, you know, in the world. The Fulton Fish Market moved up from Manhattan to join the Hunts Point Food Distribution Center a while ago. So, you know, that site tells a story about how we get fed, but it also importantly tells a story of the environmental degradation experienced by, you know, the tens of thousands of people who live in Hunts Point and who are now, you know, impacted by the trucks that go in and out all the time, you know, by the expressway that cuts off the peninsula, you know, by the dirty industry that, you know, is developed around a site like this. So that's the kind of story and the kind of place that we don't think guidebooks normally focus on.
Another good example of that is on Staten Island at the Amazon warehouse, right? Which recently unionized and very fortuitously is in our book. Most guidebooks aren't going to send people, you know, few guidebooks send people to Staten Island. And period, right? And then in Staten Island, going to a warehouse seems like an odd place to send people. Right. But then it turns out it's, you know, it was the center of lots of health and safety struggles during COVID and walkouts and labor organization and an independent union now.
Right. Clearly an important part of the vibrancy of New York and certainly the vibrancy of working class New York. Carolina, I'm curious, what role does disappearance play in the life of New York and in the stories your book tells?
So it's certainly a theme in the book, and there's another great book, Vanished New York, that talks a lot more about disappearance. I think we were really trying to strike that balance of the three kinds of sites that, you know, I just talked about, but certainly, you know, part of the landscape of the city, part of the geography of the city is that it's a city that gets kind of recreated because we are bound, we're islands, right? So it's, you build up, you tear down, you build up, you tear down. So that inevitably leads to disappearance. Right. And these layers that, you know, I've been talking about that, you know, the site was once this, it's now this, then it went back to being this other thing, you know. So I think that unlike some other cities, for example, Los Angeles, where, you know, you also see disappearance, the geography of New York makes that much more felt. Right. And experienced in the daily life of New Yorkers. Like you walk, you know, you're walking around the city and you're like, oh, that used to be this and that used to be that, in ways that you don't, it doesn't feel the same way in other cities.
Yeah. And I think it's also the politics of, you know, and economy of New York and also its history. But, you know, New York is one of the oldest and, you know, has almost always been the most populous city in the United States. But unlike other historical cities, it really doesn't give a damn about history. I mean, that's been a real issue in New York. And, you know, it's pretty reflective of how much, you know, private wealth and capitalism and real estate wealth, you know, makes this city what it is, you know, for better and I would say more often worse, but, you know, so it's profitable to always put up new stuff and, you know, it's great to always be at the cutting edge of everything. And the destruction that takes place here, you know, has really been concerted and rampant, you know, and I mean, I think most of us who are New Yorkers know the story of how, like, Penn Station, the beautiful Penn Station, was torn down. And that's what kind of awoke, you know, in the consciousness of preservationists, the fact that New York should pay some attention to its history. But that historical preservation movement, and, you know, we could talk about that, but, you know, that I think it runs counter to the general trend that Carolina is describing, you know, and there are real tensions in the city, I think, you know, around those questions.
Yeah, I know my uncle, who's a native New Yorker and a real theater lover, often when we would go watch shows on Broadway, we'd pass some building and he would, like, you know, almost kind of cry, oh, that, you know, there was a great old, you know, historical theater, and then they tore it down, and here's, you know, now this ugly, you know, building was put up in its stead. And it seems like there's a continuous process of tearing down old buildings and putting up things that often don't seem to compare in terms of the beauty, the aesthetic, and obviously the history of the buildings that were torn down.
Yeah.
I'm curious. You said that at some point there began to be a consciousness around the need to preserve historical buildings in New York. When did that begin, and how has that effort played out so far?
I mean, if I'm remembering correctly, and we don't talk about this in the book, I think it was 1961 that Penn Station was torn down, and the Landmark Preservation Society, and again, I might be getting the specific titles wrong here, was started in earnest. So it really did start with the tearing down of the old Penn Station and the replacement with what we have now, the Madison Square Garden complex, which... there's now a new train station in New York City called the Moynihan train station in the old post office that is trying to kind of, you know, recapture some of the glory of the old Penn. But I think most people would strongly agree that it doesn't, even if it's nice. Anyway, so I think that's when it started. But what's unusual about that movement, and I don't feel really expert here, is that, you know, what, and I think our book comments on this, is like what gets called important and historical is going to be the product of social struggles and power itself, right? And so, unfortunately, you know, many neighborhoods that get like the historical markings around them are often first white neighborhoods, or often first rich neighborhoods, you know, are often first neighborhoods where the people who live there have the social power to demand the preservation, right? Yes. And so just getting those landmarked districts and getting that landmark status is always a struggle. You know, one site we have in the book that talks about the other, you know, the losing side of this is Dorothy Day, who people may be familiar with. She was one of the founders of Catholic Worker. She spent her last years in Staten Island. They Catholic Worker had farms on Staten Island. I mean, it's a really fascinating story. But she lived in this area, you know, along the coast that was known as, like, I think they're called like the Spanish houses or something, or the Spanish cabins. I'm forgetting the name. They had been run by a bunch of Spanish anarchists in the earlier part of the 20th century. And then Dorothy Day lived there, and people wanted it to be a historical landmark, right? I mean, here's Dorothy Day, incredibly important person, you know, like up for canonization, you know, like that, that level of important personage, and a beautiful historic site, which, you know, because there was a real estate developer who wanted to come in and make some beachfront property in Staten Island, you know, so smart during climate change, you know, got the rights to the area and tore down, you know, the bungalows, that's what it was, the Spanish bungalows, before, you know, the decision could be made by the city. And of course, you know, they were going to win anyway, right? So there's always struggle in relationship to this, you know, what gets counted as landmarked. But it's definitely been around for over half a century now, that push.
Yeah, the thing that comes to mind is in Brooklyn, the Duffield Street homes that were linked to the Underground Railroad, and one of them, you know, there were three and or two, and one of them is no longer, and one of them, they're still fighting for one of them. So that is a common story throughout.
Right. And to step back a little bit historically, Carolina, could you tell us when and why were the five boroughs united into the Greater New York?
That's great. I think it was 1894. You're getting
1898.
Well, maybe I think Penny should answer this one.
Sure. Penny, take it away.
So New York was, you know, just New York's Manhattan and the Bronx, and Brooklyn was its own thriving city. In fact, it was, I think, today it would be like the fourth largest city in New York City if it was a city. But Queens was its own kind of collection of towns. I mean, it didn't have an urban center the way that Brooklyn did. And in fact, that's why Queens, those of us who are familiar with it, know that you actually, your address is not Queens, New York, it's your neighborhood. So you live in, like, you know, Forest Hills or Kew Gardens or Astoria. And that's how you sign off in your Queens addresses. So the city was united finally in 1898. And very much, I mean, we describe it as almost a kind of colonial enterprise of Manhattan, you know, taking over the outer boroughs, recognizing that, you know, having greater land, you know, more space, especially for, you know, the extremely expanding population of immigrants and poor people to move out. You know, they saw it as moving out of Manhattan to create more space, and to create more space for industry and development for the purposes of Manhattan, you know, was very much the kind of vision of it. And so there was a lot of support for unification from within Manhattan, and a lot more resistance, actually, like from Brooklyn, which was concerned that its, you know, power and status would be diminished, as it was. It was also, you know, there were also big cultural differences between the leaders, you know, the political elites of the different cities. You know, Brooklyn was much more Protestant. New York was much more Catholic. Brooklyn had a lot more well-to-do people. You know, Manhattan had many more impoverished people, et cetera.
Right. And speaking of some of these internal tensions, how does the tension between, Carolina, hopefully this question will stick. How did the tension between cosmopolitanism and provincialism play out in New York City?
Well, that's one of the great themes of the book, right? That even though from the outside, everybody looks at New York City and thinks, wow, what a cosmopolitan place. The reality of New York City is that everybody lives in their four square blocks. That I have students who have never been outside of Manhattan. I have never been outside of Brooklyn, who have never been on the subway, who live in Mill Basin or Gravesend, and in my class, it was the first time I made them take the subway. Right. So people are very rooted in their neighborhoods. And sometimes that can reflect a kind of provincialism and a kind of conservatism also, right? That, oh, this is what I know. I'm living with people I'm familiar with culturally, in terms of language, in terms of ethnicity. And even though we think of New York City as this incredibly diverse place, which it is on the whole, it is also a deeply segregated place, right? And so those things are constantly in tension with each other. You can have access to incredible sources of culture, museums and art and music and theater, and street art, you know, in this incredibly kind of cosmopolitan way. And you can also be neighbors with people who think really differently and who don't want to leave the city and who, you know, literally, you know, don't leave their neighborhoods.
Right. Definitely. And Penny, how does the tension between the private and public sectors play out in New York City?
So, I mean, New York is pretty extraordinary, and we argue somewhat exceptional in the United States context for both having extreme power in the hands of private citizens and privately wealthy people, right? And at the same time, having a really robust public sector and public infrastructure that has been, you know, won over, you know, a century of struggle. And even when it is underfunded and under attack, it nevertheless persists. You know, so for example, we have the City University of New York that we all, you know, teach at, and that's amazing. I mean, there's no comparable city university system, I think, in the world, right? I mean, 25 campuses and, you know, low cost, what used to be free, entitled public higher education, you know, up until 1975. We have public hospitals, you know, a really robust public hospital system. We obviously have the most developed mass transit of any city in the country. We have a lot of public space. We have a lot of, you know, open public access to so many parts of New York. You know, there's one private park, Gramercy Park. And there's another one. That's right. There's another one. And there are some, you know, like there are some privatized spaces that, you know, like the far end of the Rockaways. What's the name of that community that is like somewhat of a gated community? Seagate? Is that what? I don't remember what it's called. We don't want to badmouth Seagate if it's not. But, you know, but in general, like much of New York is highly like public in both, you know, the institutions that exist here and I would also say in the lifestyle that we create. But at the same time, you know, for 12 years at the beginning of the 21st century, the richest person in New York City was also our mayor. Right? So, you know, it's just the amount
of Michael Bloomberg.
Exactly, Michael Bloomberg. So the amount of power that the private sector exercises is also, you know, phenomenal. And you can't walk around New York without seeing, you know, the names of, you know, there's the, you know, all the Carnegie Libraries and Carnegie Hall. There's, you know, the Astor wing of this place and the, you know, those terrible Purdue Pharma people, the Sacklers, you know, who still have their name on one wing at the Met, but used to have a lot more. You know, all over New York, you see that kind of power, and you certainly see it in the politics of New York as well.
All right. Speaking of the politics, Carolina, is New York City a place where, quote, anything goes? In other words, what is the relationship between the freedoms and the repression found in the city?
Another big central tension, right? That in some ways it is anything goes, right? That people, you know, don't bat an eye lid at lots of things they see on a daily basis. Things that we used to call in sociology, you know, kind of norm violating, that just become part of the fabric of the city. And at the same time, it is a place, it is a heavily, a place of heavy repression. Police repression, police in schools, you know, when I've had family visit from Chile, the first thing they comment on is, why are there metal detectors in schools? Why are there security guards in schools?
In public schools.
the way that protest is policed and repressed, and the barricades and how people are penned in, are all great examples. And throughout history, right, we see examples of tremendous repression for protest in the city. So at the same time, so there's a lot of personal liberties, while a lot of structures, right, of repression. Yeah.
Right. Go ahead, Penny. Do you want to add to that?
Well, I just want to, because I 100% agree with what Carolina just said, but I would want to play up a little bit the kind of anything goes-ness, because New York, and again, I think this in part stems from the kind of public nature of our lives here and the extent of interchange that is both, forced by the city and its geography and our patterns of interaction, and also welcomed by the city. We have an incredibly diverse population from, all over the world at all times. So we've had amazing, explosively creative movements come out of this city, right? Which to me are the, artistic movements. Hip hop, punk rock, salsa, that's just on the musical front. If you look at the amazing innovations people have made in all different arts and, learning and politics, I just think that, New York has given all that up. At the same time, it has, lived under the kinds of repression that Carolina talked about.
Right. And of course, some of the, maybe it's ironic or maybe not, but some of the protest movements that you were kind of alluding to were themselves protests against police repression. So they were in direct response to police repression. I think of Stonewall, if you think of various protest movements that were literally responding to the overreach and violence on the part of the local government against various minorities and disenfranchised populations.
Absolutely. And we tell the stories of places like Stonewall and also Black Lives Matter, right? The, horrific death of Eric Garner in Staten Island, which, was part of the earlier rendition of Black Lives Matter movement. So yes, absolutely.
Right. Carolina, could you give our listeners a sense of the breadth and scope of the entries in the book?
So one thing that was really important to us was to give a view of the whole city. And that means talking not just about Manhattan, but of Queens, of the Bronx, of Staten Island, of Brooklyn. And thinking through decentering the center, right? So even though there's a lot of sites in Manhattan, most of the book is made up of sites in all the other boroughs, right? The other boroughs kind of combined make up the bulk of the site. So that was an important intervention for us, because Manhattan is so highlighted in other guidebooks and even alternative guidebooks, radical guidebooks. We really wanted to, so geographically, we wanted to cover all five boroughs, but in terms of the kinds of sites, we also wanted to be thinking about the various movements that have sprung up in the city, social movements, labor movements, early movements for what we now call the rights to the city, housing, healthcare, but also just arts, right? Culture, racial and ethnic communities, education. The book covers a lot, and we had a lot of debate and discussion about the kinds of stories we wanted to tell and which locations were the best place to tell those stories without being too repetitive. We also wanted to make it, the LA guy, LA is a harder city to get around, right? New York, you have this incredible opportunity to take public transit, to walk around. So we really wanted to get people to walk around with it and create clusters of sites so that if you're going to Brownsville, you can, you're not just going to one place. Brownsville is, it's not that hard to get to, but it's not that easy. And so you want to go to the Margaret Singer birth control clinic and the Brooklyn Labor Lyceum and Weeksville, which is not too far away. And so really thinking about the walkability and the clusters also.
Right. I'm curious if you could give an example of a particular theme or concept that you wanted people to get access to, and where you thought, well, there's multiple physical locations that could tap into, that history or that idea, and then you decided to choose one site as opposed to another. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And this might come from like the bias that certainly Carolina and I bring to this, but like labor struggles in New York City, right? I mean, turn of the century of the 19th to 20th century, labor unrest. There are so many different places, we could pick to look at it. And, we were compelled, I think, for very good reasons, to pick, Tompkins Square to tell part of that story, because it was at Tompkins Square that, some of the earliest actually police riots, to speak to what you were talking to, Salman, of the police repressing a labor rally there. But I would say that, we chose two different other places, and again, of like many, many. One was the tramway strike that Jocelyn Wills wrote for us. I think it's called Trams. Was it the trolley?
The trolley strike.
See, I'm getting my transportation up. A trolley strike that took place in Brooklyn, and also a story of in Astoria, the Steinway piano factory and the company town that was created there by the Steinway company. And we chose those sites in part along the same lines as what Carolina's talking about, to get us out of Manhattan, to recognize that, these struggles take place in all the boroughs, and to highlight the different experiences of workers during that whole long, important stretch, that you could basically say, of industrialization and before labor unions really came to be. And by picking these three sites to touch on that super long story, I think we were able to kind of tell that whole story, without sacrificing a ton of it, but not being overly repetitive.
Right. Fascinating. I'm curious, Penny, were there any sites that that you really wished you were able to include, but for some reason they didn't make the cut?
I should be more prepared to remember this, because there were a bunch of cuts. I mean, so what I'll say is there were many sites that, like, for example, Max's Kansas City, right, which was a club that, was very important to both like the art scene in New York, the abstract expressionists and mid 20th century artists all hung out there. And then, Velvet Underground and the music scene at Max's was key. We told the story of CBGBs, so we don't tell the story of Max's, right? But it was an amazing site, and we developed it. There were other things that ended up on the cutting room floor, the Theater Fire, right, in Brooklyn, a wonderful site that we ended up not including. You know, Turtle Bay had some interesting stories that we developed, and that was where the UN was created. And again, it was this question of urban development and urban renewal, but we told that story by looking at San Juan, you know, Hill and the development of Lincoln Center. So, you know, you make a choice about which one you're going to pick, but they were very similar stories. I don't know, Carolina, if you have others.
Yeah, I was just going to say there, you know, we also did that with like important people, like Malcolm X. Where are we going to put the Malcolm X story? Like Malcolm X needs to be in our book. Is it going to be the Audubon? That's kind of a well-known story, you know. The house that he lived in Queens is like a subway and a bus ride. It's really in deep in Queens. There are people who live there, and there's a little plaque. Are we really going to send people, you know, are we going to tell my story there? No, we ended up with the Malcolm X story. Clarence Taylor wrote it at the 28th Precinct, right? So there were lots of discussions about where we tell, where it makes sense, right? In terms of lots of criteria to tell particular stories, whether that's geography or wanting to pick up something that people might not already know.
Right, right. It seems like you have to have a balance between saying something new or different, you know, that hasn't been said, but also connecting it to the history and places that people know. If people pick up your book and they don't recognize any of the sites in your book, like, this seems not like an alternative book. It seems like an alternate universe, you know. So there needs to be some kind of balance there. That makes a lot of sense. Carolina, I'm curious, are there particular themes that emerge from reading the stories of the sites in your book?
So I think some of the themes we've talked about, and some of the tensions we've talked about, but for me personally, I think one thing that came out of, I worked on a lot of the Brooklyn sites, and one thing that came out for me that even though in the back of my mind I knew, I didn't really know to the, you know, the extent to which it was true, is just Black history in Brooklyn, you know? And the richness of it and the variation and variety of it. So from, you know, school board boycotts to, you know, colored school number two to Weeksville. One of my favorite stories is the Ebinger Baking Company boycotts that were initiated by the by CORE in the 1960s, right? So Ebinger's is this famous bakery on the East Coast. It's famous for its, you know, Brooklyn blackout cake. And they weren't hiring Black people. They weren't hiring Puerto Ricans. And CORE decided, you know, this is... we're going to make this a campaign, and we're going to boycott Ebinger's. They developed these strategies. They had pickets. They had pickets at the actual bakeries. And when those pickets weren't so successful, they went to the depot and they blocked trucks, you know. And eventually they forced the company, right? I mean, not being a union, not being a labor organization, but deeply focused on labor and the working, you know, the access to work for people of color, they forced Ebinger's to have to sit down, to have to revisit their hiring practices. You know, it was a mixed bag in terms of success. Like, they had some wins and some losses. But at the end of the day, this group of radicals was able to force, you know, this company to sit down and essentially bargain over employment. And today you can still see it, Like, you can go to Albemarle Road and look at the depot. It's now a CubeSmart. But when you look up at the sign, it still says Ebinger's, and you can be, you know, transported back to that incredible history. You know, where the trucks left the the depot is where the trucks go in to unload goods today. So you the photo that we have in the book, you look at it and then you look at the building and you still see the same entrances, right? And so for me, it was just like really incredible to see and to write about and to be in these places where you could connect so directly to history, and, you know, almost feel like you were there or feel like you were part of that movement because, you know, the structure exists. And so I would say that for me, that was one of the most important themes coming out of Brooklyn.
Right. Well, that really is remarkable. And to be able to be, as you said, transported back to a different era in New York City history is really a very special and potentially an experience that people could really grow from. You know, you feel like if you're reading, you know, the history books about the civil rights movement or you know, radical movements in America's past, and then you could go to a building where something related to that history actually happened, and you feel, like you said, a kind of deep personal connection to that site and then potentially to those struggles, to those concerns. That really is a very special thing to do. So speaking of personal attachments, I'm wondering if I could ask each of you if you have a particular favorite site from your book that you want to highlight. Why don't we start with Penny?
You know, I feel like I've already spoken to some of my favorite sites. Like, I love Dorothy Day, and I love the Village East Cinema and Hunts Point. But, you know, one thing I was thinking about when talking about Hunts Point, and it was mentioned by Carolina, like, in terms of fights for the right to the city, we have two sites in the book that tell stories of the Young Lords, which was a revolutionary Puerto Rican group started in 1969, kind of maybe it was end of 68, but kind of very similar to the Black Panthers. And they were not around for a very long time, but they had a really disproportionate impact, I would say, on the city in a bunch of directions. There's a wonderful book that I would recommend that came out somewhat recently that if folks, you know, would want to learn more, Johanna Fernandez's The Young Lords, A Radical History is a really great book. But anyway, so the sites I would pick are Lincoln Hospital in the Bronx, where the Young Lords took it over. It was a public hospital that was, you know, under deep cuts and disarray and not serving the community. They had an occupation. It was successful. The entire community, you know, got involved, backed them up. A new hospital was built as a result. And another similar site known as the Garbage Offensive in East Harlem, where the Young Lords, listening to the community, listening to the anger people felt about the extent of, you know, lack of garbage collection. This is a period when a lot of buildings had been torn down in East Harlem. And, you know, there were a lot of abandoned lots and, you know, infestations and garbage everywhere. New housing projects sprung up, you know, community really under pressure from all this development and redevelopment, but a lack of services. And so the young people in the Young Lords took the brooms from the sanitation department and started cleaning up the street, and they piled garbage in the middle of all these intersections in East Harlem to make a spectacle of the city's neglect. And in doing that, they won garbage access. I mean, you know, they won garbage pickup, and they won the attention, you know, to the community that it deserved. So I love those sites because I feel like we often in New York imagine ourselves powerless, you know, against the, you know, the powers that be, and we're not, you know, and there are so many fantastic stories of people claiming, you know, the right to a livable, healthy, you know, clean city and making that happen through their own self-activity.
Right, right. That is really fascinating. Carolina, do you have a favorite site to highlight?
So I would say, you know, Ebinger's was definitely one of my favorites. And I would also say Fresh Kills Park in Staten Island is another favorite, just because it has this incredible story of being, you know, a garbage dump for many, many, many years, and to transform, you know, to it also just highlights how Staten Island was seen by the central city, right? That as a place to dump garbage, the city, you know, the city's garbage, and for that to be transformed into this incredible, enormous, you know, fresh, beautiful park today that people can enjoy and be in nature in, I think is an incredible story. Similar to that story is also Flushing Meadows, right? And the Valley of the Ashes. And again, I think one of the things that Penny had highlighted is just like, why did that happen? Because of people, because people pushed for it, because people said it was unacceptable, right? It's unacceptable to be living with this garbage dump, right? This should be a public park. So I would say those two are some of my favorites. Yeah.
Right. Thank you for that. All right. Here's the last question, Penny. What do you hope readers will take away from your book?
Well, I mean, so many things. I hope that people who read the book, either if they're in New York or if they're not in New York, see the city differently. I mean, see it, you know, literally through like different glasses, you know, either as they walk around or as they imagine it. You know, I think there are a lot of, and I want to say, I feel like our book is in a really proud tradition, and I would feel honored to join it, of people who have tried to make visible the hidden New York and, you know, and show it to people. But I think one of the contributions we make is this question of social power and the volatility and, you know, and struggle that goes into the creation of what is both great and terrible about New York. And so I would hope that people appreciate that, appreciate the flux, you know, and how the flux, you know, we often, you asked us earlier about this kind of vanishing question. I think there's a kind of tragedy that we associate with vanishing, right? A loss, and of course there is tragedy, but there's also a lot of hope, you know, in the flux, and a lot of hope in the instabilities that get created in the social struggles that we see around us. And I would hope that, you know, New Yorkers in particular maybe see that hope and see those lines to, you know, to power and to, I don't know, to victory for the kind of New York we want to live in, you know, that's what you would get out of our book.
Right. Well, that's a great answer. We're going to have to leave it there. Obviously, there's so much more to explore in your book and in New York City. Thank you for taking the time to share your thoughts with us today.
Thanks for having us. It's been great.
Yeah. Thank you, Salman.
That concludes our program. Thanks for listening and have a great day.